The Jack B Show, where pit smarts meet street smarts. Now, here's your host, Jack Berusian.
Hey, welcome, everybody. Happy Tuesday to you. Happy April 30th, the last trading day in April, folks. And for those of you that are not aware of it, there's always an adage that they throw out there. They say you sell in May and you walk away, and we're going to talk a little bit about that and whether that's even true this time around with April that gave us another boost in the market. But let's talk a little bit about today's trade. Again, as I said to you before, the last trading day of April, market was a little mixed in the morning if you noticed, but what I liked about today's action, folks, is the fact that you saw the dollar stabilizing. Remember, we saw strength in the dollar, which over the course of the last few months I've been saying, you know, I've been surprised at the relative strength in the dollar, especially when you talk about the strength in the equity markets. But we have got an equity market that is making another all-time high. You're looking at some of these other markets, commodity markets, especially stabilizing. Remember, we were looking at gold down with a 13 number. In fact, there were people calling for $1,000 gold just about a week ago, which I absolutely love. Especially being a bull, and I love the fact that the ETF effect came into play. And for those of you that sent those emails that saw me on CNBC last week, yes, as you well know, because you've heard me say it many, many times, commodities trade differently. All right? They trade different than stocks, and people don't understand that. But a lot going on today. We had a two-day Fed meeting that started. Case-Shiller Index came out a little better than people expected. Chicago PMI, a little worse than people expected. And then consumer confidence, better than expected. We'll go through each one of those things. Case-Shiller was up around the board. Actually, 1.2, I think, was what it was when you took the 20 cities all together. But as I said yesterday, a lagging indicator. Not a big fan of the Case-Shiller Index, but it's a lagging indicator. It's one that people don't think should pay as much attention to as they do. The second thing that came out was Chicago PMI, which is an important number. That came out well below the forecast of 52. Under 50, folks, is contraction. It came out at 49. Remember, one number does not an economy make. I would use that as a bit of a precaution. But as our guest who's going to come on in a little bit, Alan Rohrbach, will be so quickly to tell us, that could be a precursor to Obamacare and some of the other hiring problems that we might be facing down the road. But the one number that I really think was really a fun number was consumer confidence, which was expected at about 61, 62, came out at 68. That is a bullish number, folks. It's one of the numbers that put the wind in the sails of the market. And, you know, remember, you've got a few things happening, and let's keep that in mind with the last trading day of today. You have got what they call that artificial settlement, which is a settlement to fair value. And why? Because you have got a lot of money, and I'm talking about hundreds of billions of dollars, that are indexed using the S&P 500 futures. So what they do at the end of the month for the sake of those portfolio managers, because remember, futures now trade about 15 minutes past the settlement of stocks, is that they give those portfolio managers an artificial settlement. What they do is they survey the street, they get a fair value number, then they settle the front month futures market to that surveyed fair value number. So anyway, it's something to keep in mind, especially for those of you that might hold positions overnight. Apple higher for the month. How about that? You know what? One of those things that just, I guess, I like it only because I like Apple. And I said on Larry Kudlow's show, I believe, anytime you get a good tech stock trading at 10 times earnings, guess what? It's a buy. How about that? But you know what? Let's talk markets with somebody that probably knows markets about as good as anybody I know. Of course, I'm talking about our good friend, Alan Rohrbach. You've heard him on the show. He's the founder of Roar International. You can always get him at roar-blog. He is doing a joint venture with the Bull and Bear Institute guys. You know what? He's a bit of a renaissance man. Alan, always a pleasure to have you on, my friend.
Yes, Jack. I was there. Da Vinci and I used to go party together. Definitely a renaissance.
I didn't say anything about age, although you know what? My wife and I will be in Florence in another couple of months. I'm looking forward to it. You know, especially with that new series Da Vinci on television right now.
Sure.
But anyway, let's talk markets. Let's, you know what? We can talk and reminisce about things like that. Number one, how do you feel about an S&P that's up around 1600 with a 10-year note that is telling us that it should be nowhere near 1600? I guess is the question. I guess I'll start with that. And then we're going to work around the world and then end up right back in the U.S. How about that?
I think that's great, Jack. And it is a function of a good news is good news in the U.S. and in large measure, and bad news is good news overseas. So the thing we've discussed repeatedly, and I'll just be very succinct because your regular listeners have heard it before, is that the equities trade off anticipation of future earnings. What's the equity market but a way to leverage the earnings stream? Bonds trade off of the mostly current news coming out. What's the condition of the economies? Well, the condition of the economies isn't that great. And it's not just, of course, the notes and our equities here. Even more so than the notes, the European bonds are up. Even the peripheral bonds now, because everyone says they're
slowing.
What's with
the German bond? And I don't want to jump ahead because I want to get to Europe in a second. But what is this fascination right now with bonds, I guess, across the board, when I'm looking at equity markets that seem to be just ripe to go up?
Because, good question, and it's because the bonds are saying the equities are up because of the clever management being able to manufacture profits in a weak economic environment, and equities are entitled to do that. That's not to cast dispersions on the equity market, but the bonds are up at the same time because they're saying, we just don't have any sense inflation is going to pick up and may even diminish further from where it's at. This showed up in the German CPI numbers yesterday.
Well, you know,
Jack,
what? I'm glad you brought that up. Let's jump into Europe right now. I'm going to go to Europe, then we're going to go to Asia, then we're going to come right back here to the States. Europe, I've got an ECB meeting. I heard rumors. And I hate spreading rumors, but I was on the phone with my friend who is a portfolio manager out of Paris, and basically what he was telling me is that he's expecting 50 basis point cut. He said that there is no inflation. The Europeans are setting us up for a big cut. The ECB is setting us up for a big cut. Give me your take on that, and do you see anything that would lead you to believe that? Because you're one of the bigger Europhiles that I know.
Well, there is a lot of pressure for a cut on the back of these falling inflation numbers and the still terrible economic numbers generally. You know, we hit new all-time high Eurozone unemployment substantially on the back of the rise in places like Greece and Cyprus, but also France. German confidence is slipping. So there's every justification if Mario Draghi decides he wants to cut.
Why wouldn't he? I mean, inflation is their mandate. They always worry about inflation, and they really don't have anything as far as growth goes. But, you know, and it looks like right now the only thing that's really left for them to do, especially with a tame inflation outlook, is to go ahead and cut rates. Why wouldn't they? Explain that to me and the listeners.
For the same reason you've discussed, as the zero interest rate policy here has not necessarily translated into further business and general economic activity, which is once you're at a zero interest rate policy, the central bank basically has sidelined itself. Now, that doesn't mean it can't help psychologically, like all of the additional bond purchases the Fed is doing, et cetera, but the bonds aren't up because the Fed's buying them. The bonds are up because the lack of any prospect of inflation.
You're talking about bonds. Let's stay on Europe for a second. Why are Italian bonds doing well? Why are some of these bonds that you and I thought would be the absolute, you know, they would be literally the baby would be thrown out with the bathwater, okay? Why is it that they are the ones that seem to be doing well in this environment? That's what I think that a lot of the bears don't understand. Those that are watching Europe and seeing the Italian bonds, the Spanish bonds, not react as if Armageddon is looming. So I think that's the part that needs to be explained to people.
That's very true, Jack, because it's counterintuitive to think, as an example, the German Bund would be so strong, which normally had strength during the previous crisis phases. It would have strength as a haven, and you'd see what they call the spreads go out, where Italian yields would go from 2% over, or Spanish yields especially, 2% over, German yields out to 3.5% or 4% over. And that leads us back to, I'm going to answer that question, but just to preview it, it's going to lead us back to why Mario Draghi would still be reluctant to cut rates. But the reason those bonds are going up is that, number one, the actual banking crisis is starting to die down in Europe, much like part of our strength is the fact the next time there is any kind of slowdown, you're not worried about the banks going bust here. Well, the the banking crisis in Europe, especially Deutsche Bank, did a big rights offering the other day where they're going to go raise more capital.
A few billion dollars.
Exactly.
Saw that. Yep.
So there's less of a sense the banks could go bust. And once you're past the actual financial system crumbling, people are more comfortable buying those peripheral bonds. Now, they're still at very elevated yields to Germany, where, you know, you're just crossing below 4% in Spain, and you're actually approaching 1% in Germany. But the general sense is slowing economy. We're not worried about these countries leaving the euro, defaulting on the bonds. Those bonds look like they're a good bet right now. And this gets back around to the other question you asked, which is a very good question. So what's the reason Mario Draghi wouldn't cut at all, even from 75 basis points, 0.75%?
Which is where it's at right now.
Right. Down to a half on Thursday, and some people are even looking for him to cut fully 0.5% to 25 basis points, quarter of a percent interest rate. Why wouldn't he do that? Because in the real world, what's wrong with Europe is the premium companies, corporate borrowers, are having to pay still in places like Spain and Italy and even France to some degree, but then especially the real basket cases like Portugal and Greece. And cutting that base rate by 0.5% is going to stimulate more activity in Germany that actually is already fairly strong. At the same time, it doesn't really do anything for the corporate borrower, the business borrower in the peripheral countries.
No, that makes plenty of sense, Alan.
It's a purely psychological move, in other words. And the question is he going to evolve in psychology the same way the Fed did with the asset purchase program, the Bank of England, now Bank of Japan? He's the last man standing who said, I'm going to still want an interest rate, an overnight lending rate, where people can make money overnight in the European Union. He's going to forgo that once he gets, especially if he gets down to 25 basis
points. Let's do this. Let's keep working our way around the world. I want to, you know what, before we get to China and to what's going on in Japan, just want to mention that last week was the Armenian Genocide Memorial Day, and I know we got Holocaust Memorial. That's, you know, very important things to both Alan and I. So if you don't know what the Armenian Genocide or the Holocaust are, do me a favor, folks. Go do a little research. You'd be surprised. But it's always good to understand history so that we don't have it repeated, if at all possible. But let's work our way all the way through. You like the way I threw in Turkey
I
was going by?
I like that.
But let's go to China and Japan. You know what? I've got what I call Central Bankathon. I guess I don't call it that. You called it that. Let's call it what it is. I stole it from you, all right?
Thank you, Jack.
Central Bankathon. And you know what? And it doesn't stop.
Plagiarism is one of the highest forms of flattery.
You know what? As Joe Copyright Biden said, we have nothing to lose but fear itself. you like that?
Yeah.
For those of you that are too young to remember, Joe Biden, when he ran for president once, actually had a speech, which, as it turns out, was plagiarized. So that's why I call him Joe Copyright Biden. It was a little funny bit there. I apologize. Don't throw the angry emails out there. Anyway, getting back to it, you know what? We got the Australian Central Bank meeting this week also.
Next week.
Next week.
Right.
Okay.
You told me to
keep an eye on the Aussies. You said that they're one of the more important central banks to watch.
Right.
I've never forgotten that. All right. I'm watching Abenomics taking hold out in Japan, and I'm seeing that the Chinese are very concerned because their growth rate is getting, you know, a little slower than they would like, not quite to you know, stagnation speed, but, you know, slower than the premiers that like to build that cult of personality around the leadership would be happy with. But give me your take on things over there. You know what? Let's start with China, maybe go to Japan, and then we'll end with Australia.
Well, China is succeeding greatly at something that doesn't necessarily suit the rest of the world quite as much as the rest of the world would like, which is China is incrementally, you know, it takes a long time to turn an oil tanker. You know, China's not a speedboat.
I call it turning an aircraft carrier around in a bay.
That's it. And it takes a long time to do that, but they are successfully moving over to a more consumer-oriented economy.
Do they have the consumer base to be able to do that? Because this is the question that's asked of me, because I agree with you, by the way.
Right.
But that is the one question that is asked.
And it's a great question, and he has the most fascinating answer, which, by the way, I picked up a couple years ago picked up on this from our friend David Nellis, who you know is based out in Shanghai now, suburbs of Shanghai. And
David, I hope you're doing well out there. He listens to us every now and then. So,
I'm sure he does.
I think he takes this stuff out and sends it out to his clients, and he makes money off of it, but it's okay.
And he has been, of course, out there for many years as a consultant for inward investment, people who wanted to put businesses together in China. And he has shifted lately over to more financial services focus. He's got his own brokerage out there. And he told me a couple of years ago, and I then right after he said it, I saw some articles like in the FT and in The Economist, the Chinese not only have the consumer base, but to grow it without having to pay money out on exports. This is what I was saying about what people won't like about what China's doing. They are no longer so enamored of Western product. They have their own cultural preferences on certain types of cosmetics.
Their own brand essence.
They have their own brand essence.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And for a long time in China, it was very stylish to have Rolex, L'Oreal Cosmetics, all this. And they're developing more things from their domestic cultural base. And the companies all know how to market now. They've learned well. And they're doing more true internal.
Well, I heard the same thing. And what's fascinating about that is that those that are supplying those companies in many cases are either subsidiaries of American corporations. So you're getting this interconnectivity, this incestuous relationship around the world between these corporations.
And the other thing, by it shifting from a major infrastructure build out, I mean, the city of Shanghai popped up, what was it? I think it was about 2 weeks.
Yeah, how about it?
Right.
Well, yeah, yeah, 100 million people in and around the suburbs of Shanghai.
Dave was showing me pictures of where Shanghai, you know, developed Shanghai is now. He was showing me pictures from 20 years ago.
It was a dust town.
It was a swamp.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, come on.
It really was.
And it really was. And they just said, this is it. We're building a major financial center.
They've got a lot of financial centers that they've built out of nowhere. In fact, one of the big arguments is that they're sitting empty, but people don't realize that they're empty for a reason. I think the leadership has got a plan to populate them.
Right.
You know,
will fill up across time as the consumerist culture becomes more of domestic investor
culture.
Let's
stay in Asia. Is Abenomics working?
You know, that's the other thing that relates back to China. It's fascinating that they're coming in and trying to stimulate the Japanese economy and doing a decent job of it, but there's so much cross-business production and consumption based upon their trading relationship with China that's on the outs right now because of their
tensions?
Their tensions over territorial issues.
You know
issues.
What? I was about to ask you that next, and I'm glad you brought that up because I've always thought that Japan was an indirect play into China, and now I worry a little bit about it because of the tensions that seem to be brewing between the two countries.
And Japan certainly is, let's put it this way, Japan has more of the sun and moon and stars aligned than they've had in a long time. And there is a risk factor I'll get to in a moment. But when you take a central bank governor who's perfectly happy to flood liquidity as a way to offset deflation, I mean, we were hearing about Japan is looking to reverse their deflation from early 2011. And it just has been stubborn.
Al and I worked for them back in the late 80s and early 90s, and they were talking about it back then, they never got around to
it. Right. Well, they just can't quite. Since the real estate market bust, every time you're depreciating assets, it's hard to not be in a somewhat deflationary mode. But as importantly, you have a government who's looking to continue some deficit spending. Here's the risk factor. The consumption tax goes up from approximately 4-5% currently up to 10% to help pay for all this by early 2015. They've got about a 12-month window to maybe 18 months at most where this has to really catch fire and create the kind of growth and a little bit of inflation to help offset those higher taxes. Because the last time they tried this, which is to cure the budget situation with the higher taxes, was in April of 1997. And I remember late 96 and early 97, because I was already watching, you know, the Japanese yen and the Japanese bonds then based on clients I had over in Europe and Asia. We were watching them pretty closely, and we said, boy, these Japanese consumers, they seem to be spending more, and there's that tax hike coming in, consumption tax. They're just spending. Maybe they've gotten the spending habit like the Americans.
No.
Folks,
sure enough,
there's a great New York Italian research principle at work there. Forget about it.
Is right.
It ain't happening.
I think you're right.
So
hey,
let's leave.
Let's leave Australia for next week only because that's when the Aussie Central Bank is meeting.
Yes.
But let's work our way to the shores of our own country here. You know, I've got a Fed meeting here for 2 days. I've got economic indicators that seem to be mixed. I've got a market that's on its all-time highs. You know, Alan, give me the view from 30,000 feet. Then let's talk about some of these indicators. Let's talk about the technicals in the market. And let's give listeners a real feel for what's happening here. Coming into the next couple of weeks.
The view from 30,000 feet is the Fed is a marginal factor at this point because there is every reason to expect, and what we know from the minutes, what we know from the Beige Book, what we know from Mr. Bernanke's press conferences, they're going to keep doing what they're doing until the employment rate drops down to 6%, no matter what you hear on the speeches from the dissenters. And something, Jack, I tell you, you were very right about, that is the dissenters, not just the scaremongers, not just the crisis mongers like Rubini and Taleb and all these guys and Whitney, but the people who have been anxiously concerned within the Fed about everything the Fed is doing, it's going to rekindle inflation. There's just no sign it's happening now. There may be a heavy price to pay 24 to 36 months down the road as and when the economy picks up.
Is there Fed hawk capitulation internally? Do you think that the hawks...
Absolutely. The hawks are saying, based on things remaining as weak as they are now, and other additional burdens. This Obamacare thing, we don't want to get in here now. That's a whole different show. But you're hearing more and more about people who are being told you're being cut back to part-time, and so I don't have to give you health insurance anymore. There's a whole factor going on there back on our shores. But for right now, the anticipation is bad news is good news because it will continue to encourage the Fed, and that gets around to encouraging Mario Draghi to at least cut a quarter point as a sign of further accommodation on Thursday. Now, the one other factor I would say is out of sync this week, and I know, you know, many of your listeners are probably aware of this, but the U.S. and U.K., along with Australia, will be releasing their purchasing managers' indices on time, which is first of the month, tomorrow.
Well, we saw the Chicago PMI come out today, right, which was a little weaker than expected.
And we're going to get the ISM,
yep,
right, tomorrow, along with the U.K. and Aussie and China. Tomorrow is one of those classic holidays in Europe.
It's May Day.
It's, pardon me, Jack, it's Labor Day. What are you, some kind of commie?
You know what?
May Day.
It's,
what May Day? There are no communists anymore. Stop that May Day stuff.
It's May Day. I don't care what you say. It's so funny.
I know. Me too.
Well, the reason I call it
May Day. It's politically correct to not call it May Day anymore.
As silly as it sounds, I completely forgot. And we're doing business with China, and I called up, and there was no answer today. I couldn't figure it out, and it's because it's the holiday. They were off. They got off a little early.
These guys know how to party. We always said the British and the Europeans know how to party. The Chinese, there's a holiday, we're going to take a week off.
Well, how about it?
Yeah.
But anyway, but you're right. In Europe is also a big celebrator of Labor Day, although they riot. They don't have barbecues like we have on Labor Day.
Europe, that's it. I mean, they're a much more constrained culture with the socialism and the social, socially repressive to some degree. For all they'll say they're more liberal, there's more rules and lines, and you can't do this,
you can't do
that.
One of my first trips to Europe, Alan, and I know we've only got a few minutes left, was, as it turns out, was on May Day in Frankfurt, where the Turkish workers were demonstrating against the German police. There were water cannons.
Right.
And this was my inauguration into the European climate.
Absolutely.
I was maybe in my late 20s at the time, and I thought to myself, is this what it's like in Europe?
And maybe it's worse there because it's dark. At certain points, you know, the endless sun in the summer turns into the endless night in the winter. The Nordic countries, these guys go out, and their idea of a good New Year celebration is go out and riot and smash up some stores.
Yeah,
that's
a good point. But hey, let's get to it. We got unemployment on Friday this week.
Yes.
I've got the ADP report. Give me your take on these numbers, and let's talk some technicals in the market.
Yes, very quickly. You do have the final comment on the previous delay. So it's a one-day delay in Europe on their manufacturing PMI. So they come out just before that ECB meeting and press conference Thursday morning.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, and so now we all assume that the ECB is going to know those numbers prior to going into that, to that decision.
Right. Before you hear the decision, they'll know them. Yeah. Even if they know them not too far before, they will know them by that time. And don't forget, folks, that press conference, if you go to the ECB's website, they make it very easy if you want to hear what actually goes on to go to the ECB homepage.
Is it in English?
Yes, it is. It is in English. And, in fact, the numbers come out about 4 hours before the ECB decision announcement. So they will have a little time to factor that in. Now, you also have, Friday's employment. Looking for, about 100 or 120 from what I heard. Still substandard.
I mean, 100, let's face it, Alan, 120,000 jobs being created barely keeps up with my son and his friends that are getting out of school.
Modestly
and
are
in the job market. It's not nearly enough to be able to get a sustained market.
It'll keep the Fed in easing mode, though. See, it's a bad news is good news kind of environment.
I mean, until we see, 300,000 plus numbers back to back, I don't think there is a chance that the Fed is going to do anything.
I couldn't agree more, and that gets us around to the technicals, which is a couple of very interesting things.
By the way, before you even go there, you gave us a number, that 32 even on the downside, I want to say.
Yeah.
Or whatever it was right on. You called it. We've been using it. We've been telling people about it. We went on TV and talked about it. And I just want to give you kudos because I think that you deserve
them. Thank
you. You know what? I'll be the first one to blame you when you're wrong. No, you actually called it.
I'm a technician, Jack. I'm never wrong. I just need adjusting.
You know what, though? You called that, and you know what? It was a good call. I just want to say that.
Well, and that's the other thing we said about the market, which is by getting all the way down to 32, if the S&P was really topping, there was a good chance we're going to hit resistance. This is the June S&P 500 future. Trades at about a $4 discount to the cash at this point.
That's right.
That there would have been resistance up at 1,568 to 70 range. Instead, they went through that level last week, and here we are back retesting the old high.
They've been holding that as a support level ever since, too, it seems like.
They actually have kind of remained out above it. They need just a very temporary retest, but they've mostly just squeezed higher.
You know what? I want to ask you real quick. We had that little flash crash, that Twitter crash the other day. What does that do to your technicals, if anything at all?
Not much, because I tend to ignore spikes, and by the close of that time period, even on the short-term charts, the market was back up in its previous range. So I didn't even have to deal with a close, because a lot of the technical indicators, it's a very good question, Jeff, because a lot of the technical indicators, even looking at 30-minute charts and hourly charts, they are recalibrated based on the close of each time period. So unless something closes well away from where it was trading previous, none of those
it's an aberration, basically, is really what it comes down to.
You took the word right out of my mouth.
I like it.
It's nothing but
pure
aberration.
Support is still intact. Give me ideas of
resistance
and targets. Because we're now in no man's land. We're getting there. In fact, I always try to tell people, when you get to no man's land, I mean, it's really now, it really becomes an art. I mean, there are projections.
Yes.
And you're looking at areas. So give me an idea of where people should be looking to lighten up.
Well,
it may be
no man's land, but it's not no oscillator's land.
That's
we still
good.
Know how far they tend to get stretched out. And Jack, you've heard this number before. We tend to look at $140 above the 41-week average. Well, the 41-week average on the S&P is up to, just about the 1465 level. And based on that,
so that should take us up to about 1605 or somewhere about there,
exactly.
Which is really, we're within $10 of there. Getting close.
Think of the beauty of that psychology as we get to early May. I have another comment on the sell in May and go away momentarily that you'll like. But for right now, the early May, if we get above 1600 and start to slip back below it, one of those psychological things sometimes signal exhaustion. Let me just say in passing, folks, the bond markets can remain good with stocks going up because of the dynamic we discussed earlier. And Jack, based on the way they've really acted the last couple of years, some wag I heard him say, the only reason to sell in May and go away is no one's got anything that rhymes with April.
You know what? I'm not a fan of selling in May and going away. I'm a big fan of maybe buying some protection, some cheap
protection.
And go and walking away because
why pay the capital gains
this
tax?
This could be a good year and we might have only seen half of it.
Absolutely.
Alan, always a pleasure, my friend.
Mine
for
too.
Alan Rohrbeck, this is Jack Berugin telling you to have a great night. We'll be talking to you tomorrow.
Views and opinions expressed in the preceding program are not necessarily those of this radio station or its sponsors and should not be construed as legal, tax, or investment advice. You should always consult the appropriate advisor before making any financial decisions. All rights reserved.